if you read my website or CWB or perhaps sometimes on TV, you'll realize and know that there are dangerous people out there. Violent crime is spiking across the city of Chicago. It's spiking across the country. And in Chicago, people are afraid. They're afraid to leave their homes. They're afraid, even if they're living on the Gold Coast, they're afraid to walk outside. They're afraid to walk up and down Michigan Avenue. They're afraid to go to the Bean, which is ground zero for gatherings. And gunshots are fired there regularly. Lori Lightfoot has no clue. Kim Fox is doing what Kim Fox is doing, which is to, you know, hug the criminals, I guess. Dangerous people. But we have our own dangerous person on the Chicago Way today. She's Heather McDonald of the Manhattan Institute, a writer for City Journal and other publications like the New York Post. She's the author of The War on Cops, and she was at Ground Zero in the forefront of broken windows policing in New York when New York decided to take its city back. Jeff Carlin is here, as always, executive producer WGN, my friend, future physics teacher, master of pies, baker of cats. Sorry. Master of Cats, Baker of Pies. Sorry, Jeff. And I'm John Cass, husband, father, Greek Orthodox Christian, editor-in-chief of your favorite website, johncassnews.com. And where are you? With the mayor in panic telling her cops to tweet out positive stories about policing while they can't even chase a criminal on foot? Where are you when the violence increases and the summer comes and the heat rises and the bodies hit the floor? Where are you? You're on the Chicago Way podcast on WGN Plus.
Look, the Chicago Way is a deep cultural phenomenon.
It's the Chicago Way.
Hey everyone, I'm Laura Ingraham. This is Ingraham Angle from Washington. The Chicago Way, that's the focus.
In a tower by the river, there lived a man.
Hello.
There was a man who took a stand. With pen and paper in his hand. Defeating foes in every ward with a pen more mighty than the sword. No escape from his ink lasso. In a tower by the river, Castle.
Here's how you get him. He pulls a knife, you pull a gun. He sends one of yours to the hospital, you send one of his to the morgue. That's the Chicago Way.
With Chicago in chaos and anarchy, and the rule of law threatened not only here, but nationally, with the leftist protesters around the homes of Supreme Court justices exerting their will, who better to talk to than Heather McDonald? She's a well-known writer of many books and articles. She's a senior fellow at the Manhattan Institute now, and she's written, well, for example, The War on Cops. And we have a war on cops here in Chicago, even though my former colleagues, particularly the Jacobins at the in the newspaper guild, don't want to hear it. But every day we have more and more people on the police force leaving and fewer coming on the force. And it's we're in the summer of joy, so where people are being shot all over. So with that, welcome Heather McDonald to the Chicago Way.
Well, John, thank you so much. It's a real honor to be with you. And Chicago is fortunate to have a voice like yours. I wish we had something like you in New York City, because you are the ballast to the left-wing ideology that has done so much to destroy Black lives and to destroy the vitality of cities.
I thank you for the kind words, Heather. And I hope that some of my colleagues have many tissues so they could either cry into them or wipe up what's left of their exploding heads as you speak. But clearly, we are in a bad place in Chicago and a bad place in the country. And I've always thought that a lot of it has to do with the demonization of police and this, I guess, for lack of a better word, woke nonsense involving criminal justice reporting, where every cop is a criminal and a racist. Why did you write that book, first of all? Let's go to that. Why did you write The War on Cops? And since then, you've written other pieces for the City Journal, which I hope to write for someday. And why did you do it?
Well, I hate idiocy. I hate lies. And it was rather easy pickings, if you want to go after both, to take on the anti-cop narrative. Everything the public thinks it knows about policing and crime and race in this country, reverse it and you're likely to get the truth. I predicted the first, what I call the Ferguson effect, the first result of what you rightly call the demoralization of cops, John, following the Michael Brown shooting in Ferguson, Missouri in 2014. That led to the first iteration of the Ferguson effect, which is the combined phenomenon of officers backing off of lawful, constitutional, necessary, proactive policing. And I'm going to take a little side trip here to quickly define proactive policing. Proactive policing is discretionary. It's what officers do when they are not answering 911 calls, when they are not responding after the fact to somebody being shot by a gang member on the street or somebody being robbed or somebody being carjacked. Proactive policing is trying to stop crime before it happens by an officer's use of his powers of observation, his knowledge of crime locales, his knowledge of gang territory to intervene, to ask a few questions of that guy hanging out on a drug corner at 2 a.m., hitching up his waistband as if he has a gun, getting out of his car, you know, making an investigation. Well, when the cops are told ad nauseum by the media, by the Democratic elites, that they are racist for engaging in proactive policing, they do less of it. The other half of the Ferguson effect that accompanies depolicing is emboldened criminals. They know now that they can hang out on that drug corner with a gun because the cops are very unlikely to get out of their car and ask a few questions. And so what we saw following the Ferguson riots and that first wave of very, very loud anti-cop rhetoric coming out of not just the academy, but out of the media and the political establishment was 2015 and 2016. You saw this in Chicago, a massive increase in crime. Your mayor, Rahm Emanuel, acknowledged it. The Obama's justice attorney general came to Chicago for a meeting about what can we do as law enforcement officers about this unbelievable rise in shootings that was happening in Chicago and across the country. And Rahm Emanuel, to his credit, said the cops have gone fetal. He knew that the stops had dropped, the discretionary arrest, the drug arrest, the arrest for broken windows offenses, the summons, all had plummeted with the result that the criminals were emboldened. So 2015, 2016 saw the largest two-year increase in homicide in this nation's history. We sort of came out of that in 2017. Then we had the George Floyd race riots. And we had, you can either call it Ferguson Effect 2.0, or you can call it the Minneapolis Effect. And 2020 saw the largest increase in homicide in this nation's history, 29%. The vast majority of those additional dead bodies were Black. Not a single one of those Black dead bodies that were killed by Black criminals were protested by Black Lives Matter activists because, as you well know, the whole movement is a complete fraud. It is a complete betrayal of the public trust that anybody actually thinks they mean Black Lives Matter, when in fact it's the police for whom Black Lives Matter is the dominant philosophy. So I wrote The War on Cops in order to discredit this narrative that was destroying Black children's lives, destroying the viability of cities. You now have anarchy unleashed. You have the Magnificent Mile prey to these utterly savage mobs who have been no socialization at home. The police are the only barrier between law and anarchy. And unless we turn this phony narrative around, there's no getting our cities back.
And Heather, thanks so much for joining us too. And as somebody who's seen this type of thing firsthand, I mean, you worked in New York for the city there to kind of stem some of the violence upticks and see what policing is about. So it's not like you're just pulling this out of, you know, stats that people pull out, because that's the thing that bugs the crap out of me, is that people, they show you statistics about, oh, you know, crime was only happening here, or these people are the only one who ever interactions with police. And there's this mentality that the cops are the boogeyman and everything. And sure, there are bad cops, like just like there are bad teachers, just like there are bad bakers, just like there are bad train drivers and truck drivers. I mean, that's a thing you can't get around. That's human nature. But there's this mentality that, like, all these ills, all the things you were just discussing about these people, and I hate saying these people because it always turns around on me, but people whose children are, you know, only interaction with these cops, you know, we've let that happen as a society, and our only answer to it has been, you know, policing, because we've never addressed any of that stuff. We've never, you know, politicians have said, oh, we're going to do X, Y, and Z, and it never happens, but they get the votes. And it's left this wake of just destruction of our urban centers that were once vibrant. How do you see Chicago compared to New York? I mean, because I always feel like New York, everything happens in New York first, or LA maybe, but New York, and then Chicago kind of gets the windfall from stuff that percolates there. So how do you see the differences, or maybe some similarities, between Chicago and New York in the way policing and crime are affected?
Well, Chicago has a much higher per capita crime rate, and it's partly demographic. I'm going to be very honest here. You know, the violent street crime is really being committed by Blacks and Hispanics. That's just the fact of it. And that's who the victims are. You know, Blacks die of homicide at 13 times the rate of whites between the ages of 10 and 34. That's a significant civil rights problem. 13 times. I mean, that's being deprived of life, yeah, right, as well as liberty and property. But the reason that they die of those at that elevated rate is because they're also committing homicide at that elevated rate. And so you have a larger minority population. So that affects things to a large extent. But also, we had this revolution in policing that began in 1994 with Mayor Rudolph Giuliani and his first police commissioner, William Bratton, that embraced low-level public order enforcement, the so-called broken windows enforcement. It was the first to really become very data-driven in policing. It made precinct commanders accountable. That was a period when Chicago was still mucking around with, you know, the CAPS program that started out with making somewhat of a difference, yeah, but it quickly just degenerated. It's hard to keep those community things going.
We call that the Chicago way, Heather.
Yeah, things sort of go their own way without the intended effects. So. You know, New York had a record of a remarkable crime drop, and we held on to it for a long time. And it was continued by demographic change in New York as well. You had gentrification of neighborhoods. You had two-parent families coming in that are the guard. As you say, Mr. Carlin, the police are the second best solution. The best solution to crime is the two-parent family and socializing kids. Well, you know, I spent a lot of time in far south side of Chicago and with some of these community organizers, that their hearts are in the right places, but it's very hard to have an effect when you have the family broken down to the extent it has in inner city Black communities. And things are just, it's also the South Side is much more isolated. from the rest of the city. And so the dysfunctional ghetto culture, the underclass culture that America turns its eyes away from, you know, we all sort of briefly listened to the lyrics of rap music in the 1980s when the Gores, to their credit, said, whoa, we've got a problem here. This is glorifying violence. It's glorifying misogyny. It's glorifying the gangster life, theft, shootings. And we decided it was too horrifying. We turned our eyes away. And now we pretend that these kids that are going around shooting across sidewalks and killing one-year-olds and leaving eight-year-olds brain dead for the rest of their lives in these insane barbaric shootings, that they sort of don't exist. And the problem is guns, or the problem is the cops. It's not. The problem is the failure of socialization in inner city neighborhoods that is leading to crime rates and crime victimization, that if it happened to white people, there would be a national revolution.
If it happened to white people, if white people had schools the way, like the Chicago public schools, parents would not stand for it, and we'd have school choice immediately now. Right. Yep. But because they're black, they're sort of like, and minorities and the politics being what it is in Chicago, in New York, throughout the country with the Democratic Party, they've become clients where they've been, you know, I mean, Daniel Moynihan, the Democrat, warned us of this 50 years ago. What would happen? And it's happening. And now we see, Heather, and Jeff, we see, when I was a young reporter in town, you know, I covered crime too, and you'd see the grandmothers at the crime scene, the grandmothers who are really raising the kids. But you know what's happened, Jeff and Heather? The grandmothers are dead. They've died. And the aunts and uncles are dead, and they've gone. And what you're having now is a generation unmoored. It started, I think, I was talking to your friend Pat Fitzmorris about this just the other day, Jeff.
Yeah.
The kids are raising kids, okay? And there's no...
That's the thing. I mean, you're talking grandmothers who are in their 40s or 30s, and, you know, they're not... They've got out... Their interests are elsewhere. They're not about the children.
And it's not about white cops destroying their lives. I'll tell you that right now. It's not that at all.
But they're led to believe that, and they're led to, you know, be agitated by that and drummed up into a frenzy that, you know, is not doing anybody any favors. It's not going to turn on people into compassionate souls who are all of a sudden going to say, oh, these people have been left for nothing for so long. We should do something about it. No, they say, well, there's this part of it, this policing cop, you know, this tension between them. And of course, there's tension between groups like that, because they're both in a rock and a hard place. And we're supposed to be like, oh, yeah, we're going to all of a sudden get on and stop it here. Well, you know, we're going to stop with the cops. The cops are the problem. Well, it's like sticking a bucket in Niagara Falls and saying, well, we caught some of it. I mean, it's just insane.
We're blaming the messenger. You know, the cops tell us that there are just astronomically higher rates of violent crime in black communities. Federal data shows that black males between the ages of 14 and 17 commit gun homicide at 10 times the rate of white males and Hispanic males between the ages of 14 and 17 combined. If you take Hispanics out of that, you've got a disparity that is probably like more like 13, 14 times higher. You know, we've seen the videos of the looting. We know who's committing these crimes. We've got this phony narrative going that it's whites who are beating up on elderly Asians. No, it's not. It's blacks who have, again, failure of socialization. But we just don't want to look that hard in the eye. And instead, we've been talking about phantom police racism for the past 40 years in order not to talk about black on black crime. I remember when I first heard black on black crime being, you know, castigated as this absolutely taboo term that you just can't say that. And I sort of didn't understand why. Well, why can't you say black on black crime? But that's an absolute given in democratic discourse that you just can't talk about it. Why? Because We don't want to apply standards of personal responsibility to the inner city Black culture. And the reason is because whites are terrified that those behavior gaps and skills gaps are not going to close. And so instead, if you want to understand what's going on in the criminal justice system today, why are the Kim Foxes of the world and the Alvin Braggs and the George Gascons and the Cesar Boudins, and there's a DA in New Orleans who's in the progressive camp as well, why are they not enforcing the law? Why are they saying we're not going to enforce laws against loitering, turnstile jumping, theft, resisting arrest, attacking officers? Why? Because if we do so, it'll have a disparate impact on Blacks. And we have decided, or some part of us has decided, that rather than having a disparate impact on criminals who happen to be Black, we would rather not enforce the law at all. And we would rather blame the cops for the fact that if they go where police are, where people are being shot, and make stops, make pedestrian stops and ask questions, they will by necessity be stopping more Blacks because that's who's committing the shooting. In New York City, Blacks are 23% of the population. They commit about 75% of all shootings. Why? How do we know that? Because that's what the victims of and witnesses to those shootings tell us. If you add Hispanic shootings to Black shootings in New York, you account for virtually 100% of all shootings. So who are the cops supposed to stop? Well, if you listen to the radical activists, they should be stopping 34% of all their stops in New York should be of white people because whites make up 34% of the population. Whites are not committing the shootings, but we blame the cops for giving us the bad news about Black inner city crime.
How is media? I'm sorry, Jeff, go ahead. I'm sorry.
No, I mean, Heather, to your point there, and this is something, John, you and I have talked about. It's this cherry picking of statistics and making numbers work for you. Because sure, Heather, your point stands. And at the same time, you say, okay, well, we're using the numbers to say, well, there are too many kids, people being in prison, so we're not going to do anything. Well, you're overlooking the fact that the same numbers can be used to say, well, that population shouldn't be involved having that front facing impact like that. Heather, do you think that there's any appetite to address the things that are before the crime, you know, that are happening way down the line that are leading to all this? The idea that we're just essentially leaving these communities to rot on the vine and turning our eye to them. What would it take, really, I guess is the question from your perspective, to push that narrative ahead of the narrative that cops are the bad guys?
Well, it's very hard because you have to buck the feminists as well, because the feminists insist that strong women can do it all and that fathers are expendable. They're like an afterthought. Maybe you have a father, maybe the father's raising the child, maybe not. But now you have even Republicans who treat single mothers as some sort of ontological category. And you have people like Senator Marco Rubio, you know, talking about, oh, we have to do this and that for single mothers. Well, you know, who should be doing something for single mothers? The fathers of their babies. But the feminists have so marginalized men, they have so demonized men that, you know, one has to have courage, which I, you know, it doesn't bother me, but I'm going to stand up there and say, on average, children need their fathers. And President Obama said so as well in Chicago, which I'm sure John Cass remembers in 2008, yes, when he was running for president, his Father's Day speech at the University of Chicago. Which is
he said
a lot
of things. Yeah.
And of course, he went on to say, well, what we really need is social services. But at least he got the data out there on the statistical averages of what happens with you growing up in a single parent family. And he held Black fathers to account. But since then, you know, we've turned our eyes away again. And as far as your question, Mr. Carlo, like, what can we do at this point? To be perfectly honest, I'm asked that all the time. Same with education. What can we do? I'm kind of sick of answering it as we, because we have been doing things for decades. There's been massive transfers of wealth. There's been poverty programs. There's been redistribution, social services, welfare, you name it. And it hasn't made any difference. At this point, I think the change has to come from within the community. Now, that's not to say that elite discourse should not be celebrating bourgeois values and personal responsibility and parental responsibility. And I'll also add this, though. you know, it's sort of a conservative talking point to talk about the breakdown of the family. That's nothing new. As, you know, John rightly invoked Patrick Moynihan, Daniel Patrick Moynihan, who is an absolute prophet in saying that the breakdown of the Black family would mean the end of any further civil rights progress. And he was absolutely right. But it's easy to say, re-knit the Black family. It's hard to do because the relationship between Black males and Black females is very, very vexed. And there's a lot of mistrust there. Again, listen to rap music. I hate to recommend that to anybody, but it tells you it's a misogynist culture. And so that's a difficult thing to fix.
What's interesting to me is that now, over the last few years, since the rise of, I know I'm going to piss off my liberal friends at the paper I used to work for more than 30 years, and they drove me out of it. But the rise of the prosecutors funded by George Soros and the triggering of crime, like the small crimes that they said, oh, we're not going to put people in jail for stealing a loaf of bread, as if it was Jean Valjean and not stealing thousands of dollars of Gucci products while they're smashing the counters and freaking the hell out of shoppers in shopping districts. All that has had an effect. And the effect is that cities are dying and that Chicago is dying and perhaps even New York and other urban areas. And people are just, here's what they do, Heather, you know this, Jeff, people just vote with their feet. They can't speak about it because if they do, they're racist.
Yeah.
The media won't tell their story because the media is woke and basically stopped being journalists and are now no more than neo-Marxist propagandists. I mean, well, they're even criminal justice reporters, for God's sake. And so people vote with their feet. They leave the urban areas. They go to the red states where their kids won't get shot off the porch, and the cities begin to die even faster.
Absolutely.
That's what I see.
Oh, sure. Yeah. Absolutely. We're going to have huge, huge white flight. And we know how to fix this. You know, again, we had the model in New York. We had 2,245 homicides in 1990. That's certainly more than Chicago's ever had, but obviously we have a much larger population. It was probably 7 million back then, but still that was a pretty damn high number and brought it down to its low point to under 300. And we did that through one thing, enforcement. You enforce the law, it works. You say you're not going to enforce the law, you let the furies out of hell. And they take over. They know that they can engage in violence, in anarchy. They have the thrill of destruction, of predation, of sadism. And they can get away with it. And when you declare that, oh, we think it's racist to enforce the law, guess what happens? You're going to have a lot more crime. As far as the low-level quality of life, broken windows offenses, I have spent a lot of time in inner-city police community meetings, and it is those so-called low-level or, you know, less serious crimes that is the focus of those good law-abiding Black citizens. That's what they want to enforce. They don't want the kids hanging out on the corner by the hundreds fighting. They don't want the drug dealers hanging out on their corner in their drug sets, intimidating them. They don't want people smoking marijuana in their halls or in their lobbies. They want the parking, you know, the traffic laws to be enforced. Now that we've stopped enforcing traffic laws, because that's racist too, you have deaths by traffic, speeding in inner city neighborhoods out of control. Kids are terrified to be out on the sidewalk because people are driving like maniacs because there's no more traffic enforcement. And so the low level enforcement, which is what all these damn left-wing prosecutors say is racist to enforce, if they don't enforce it, they're the racist because they're not listening to the voices of the law abiding inner city residents who yearn for life of safety. And yes, the cities are going to die. People are not going to put up with the threat of violence and the carjackings. The crime is spreading. You know, you have your monitored gas pumping days in Chicago, carjackings in Minneapolis, in Washington, D.C., in Philadelphia, and Chicago are increasingly brutal. These kids have no respect for life. They've been dragging people, you know, in their cars that have been their limbs have been severed. New Orleans had some utterly appalling carjackings. And so people that can move will move, because you don't have to put up with this anarchy. It is not the natural condition of cities, and we shouldn't simply define deviance down another Daniel Patrick Moynihan idea and say, well, that's just, you know, what you have to accept to be an American.
It crushes me too, because we see this, and you're talking about these policies and the ideas that are driving some of the crime, but it's almost to the sense where it's like, you're going to say, okay, we're going to make a huge deal about we're social justice warriors, and we're going to remove the racist policies or racist laws and racist criminal charges. And we're going to stop covering these things and protecting people from that things. Well, they're undercutting the intelligence one of criminals, because criminals may be stupid, but they're not dumb and they're not ignorant. And they see this, and these groups, they're using it to their advantage to terrorize and improve themselves. Because when you come out of that kind of culture, that poverty level or that community, it's a, you know, get yours. It's my interest overall. And so what are they going to do? They're going to turn around and use it to their advantage. And of course, we're going to see violence spiking. So it's just this lack of foresight, even in implementing those types of changes or fixes that you call fixes, quote unquote, are just disastrous. But if we've run this for a few years now, and we're, you know, in Chicago, we're in, you know, what is it, John? It's 5 years now of Kim Fox, the four years of Kim. I lose track. It's been so bad.
We've lost track of time, because time is meaningless now that everyone's leaving, you know.
Thanks, exactly. Kim. And so what's the end game here? Heather, do you see any way that, or the ability of these cities like Chicago and San Francisco and Minneapolis, who have enacted these ways, big swings in the justice system, do you see any way we can fix this, or maybe, you know, just push the pendulum the other way a little bit? I mean, just beyond just voting people out, but isn't the damage kind of done already?
Well, first of all, let me address one thing that's sort of been hovering here, which is this whole mass incarceration idea. And you paraphrase the left, you know, we're throwing all these blacks in prison and whatnot, and we've got mass incarceration. That is just BS. You know, only about 3% of crimes ever get prosecuted or arrested for. The vast majority of prisoners in the United States, or the majority, are there for violent crimes. The fictive somebody who's smoking a joint and is thrown into a state prison is utterly absurd. That never happens. You have to work very hard to get yourself a prison sentence. Most criminals find themselves given probation numerous times. Only if they have a very, very long record will a prosecutor, a big city prosecutor, say, okay, I'm now going to throw the book at you. So we have we have a higher prison per capita population than other Western European countries. Why? Because no Western European country or Japan has our levels of violence. There's nothing comparable. Our homicide rate overall is 7 times higher than the European countries. When you look at gun homicide at certain ages, it's 43 times higher among a lower age group than the European countries. There's nothing like it. And so the fact of the matter is that incarceration is used sparingly in this country. It's down, and blacks are not overrepresented in the prison population compared to their representation in the criminal population. The prison population follows crime. It is not a racist system. As far as what can we do to fix this? Well, you know, we had a little bright spot, a little tiny glimmer, which I was ambivalent about in New York with the election of mayor Eric Adams. He had a very bad history in the NYPD. He was a captain. He was a racemonger then. He demagogued against Police Commissioner Ray Kelly based on utter lies. He perjured himself in a federal trial against the commissioner. But he reinvented himself as relatively law and order and was the most law and order in a field of candidates for the Democratic primary. And he did win. So you can say, well, that shows that at some point voters just say, I can't take this any longer. Right. We'll see if he's able to. He's only going to be able to bring crime down if he is willing to face down the disparate impact argument. Because if the cops in New York go back to enforcing the law proactively, here's what's going to happen. Inevitably, they will arrest blacks disproportionately. It is inevitable. If you're going to enforce the law in a colorblind manner, you are going to have a disparate impact on blacks, not because the police are racist, not because the criminal justice system is racist, but because blacks are committing the lion's share of crime. Eric Adams will be accused of racist policing if the police go back to policing, and he's going to have to stand up to that charge. That can happen in other cities, but you know, it's a mixed electoral picture, because the recall effort at against George Gascon in L.A. lost. They've now got a second one going. We'll see what happens in San Francisco with Chesa Boudin. It's really a question of what voters are willing to put up with. And I just scratch my head at what places like San Francisco, that they seem willing to just walk over feces and syringes and, you know, utter squalor on the streets in order to preserve their self-images as righteous progressives. So it could be turned around. It's just a question of whether there's the electoral will to do so.
I don't think the will exists in Chicago. In Chicago, that elected Kim Fox, reelected with Lori Lightfoot's endorsement, and she knew that it was a wrong thing to do. She knew that it was wrong, 100%, I can tell you. And she went for it anyway, because she had to kiss Tony Preckwinkle's ring, because the media won't ever bring up Tony Preckwinkle. And so, I mean, I did, and look what happened to me. But what's happening now then is that cops can't chase anybody. They can't run after anybody. They can't jump over a fence. Like, you know, I'm 65 and fat, so I could never jump over a fence now. But I mean, the ones who are fit and young can't do that. They can't chase anybody in a car, and they can't chase them in a foot chase. So what do you expect them to do? Here's what they do. They sit in their car and they wait to pull the plug to get the pension and leave, because they know that the media, the justice system, the judges, Tim Evans is the chief judge here, who says that when you shoot, a gangbanger shoots a child, that gangbanger is too young to understand right and wrong at 17 years old because his brain isn't fully formed. And so what happens is people leave. That's what happens. I don't see there's a will, political will to do it. And I really think both you and Jeff would agree privately that you don't really see it. I mean, I've been a reporter all my life in this town. I love this town. And I see what I see now in urban settings. The people are reinventing themselves. Cities are being reimagined. Like, you know, they say reimagining, defunding police with only with less money. Same thing. Urban areas are reimagining themselves. So you're going to see more people going to Grand Rapids. You'll see more people going to Northwest Indiana.
Yeah,
that's what's happening. I mean, tell me I'm wrong, Heather.
I agree. They're going to Montana. Yeah, they're going to different demographics for sure. So it is amazing. You would think that this problem would be self-correcting. So there's two ways, you know, there's the exit. There was a political theorist who talked about, you know, the various ways of political change, and voting is one and exit is another. And so people are opting for exit rather than sticking around and fighting. And if that remains the preferred means of bettering one's situation, you're absolutely right, John. It will not turn around. The only way it turns around is for people to say, well, I somehow am still so committed to this place that I'm going to organize and demand a restoration of law and order. But yes, your description of what cops are doing is absolutely right. That's why, again, I quoted Rahm Emanuel from 2015.
Yeah.
Telling Loretta Lynch, the cops have gone fetal. And, you know, I think conservatives get too fixated on the defund the police idea. And they say, oh, the Democrats want to defund the police, which allows people like Biden to say, I never uttered those words, defund the police. And Biden's right. But what's happened is a de facto defund the police, with cops not just sitting in their cars and waiting for their pension, but actually leaving the profession. So you're way down in cop manpower. And, you know, I see that you've been ordered, Brown is ordered on like 48, 72 hours straight of overtime for Memorial Day weekend in Chicago. This is horrible. Cops need to sleep. Cops need to sleep. If they're sleep deprived, they are at higher risk of bad tactics, putting themselves in situations where they may feel compelled to use lethal force. You know, they're not going to be as able to de-escalate situations. So this is a sign of desperation. But it's, you know, Minneapolis is down by a third because so many cops have left the force. So we don't even need an official defund the movement. What happens is cops get out of their car today and they're immediately surrounded by hostile cheering crowds, cursing, throwing things at them. The cell phones are stuck right in their faces. They can't, you know, interfering with lawful arrests. And so who wants to be a cop today?
Nobody.
Nobody. Absolutely nobody.
The nationally, what is going on, as you mentioned, with different police? Is there a database or center that has numbers of police recruiting and police leaving and retiring so that we could get a sense of this? I'm just thinking about a column, to tell you the truth. But
I've just been keeping tabs of this. It's like practically every week in the media, another city is reported as just recruiting is basically over. You cannot recruit now. And then you have these cities that are still hanging on to these absurd ideas of, oh, we need a diverse force. They should be getting anybody they can get, you know,
warm body.
And there shouldn't be residency requirements. They should maintain drug use. You know, you have to have a clean drug record. Unfortunately, in the name of getting more black cops, they've been junking the requirement that you don't have a criminal record, which is a big, big mistake. You're asking for corruption problems later down the road. But in any case,
I give you the name Pac-Man Brown. He was a Chicago. Well, we've had our share in Chicago and the Chicago way. You know, in the old days, the wise guys had their coppers, and one stupid one tried to hide some murder evidence from the FBI, which started the family secrets investigation.
Heather, say hi to Zeus. That's Zeus whining.
Oh, sorry. I'm sorry, guys.
It's okay. Zeus is a lovely dog. And John.
Zeus sounds like a squeaky door, too. We either need a food for him or you need a can of WD-40. I don't know which.
Heather, that's my chair. That's become
that, too. Podcast. Yeah, it's a character on our podcast, Heather. It's John's squeaky chair. I believe it's his creative muse, but I can't hang my hat on that.
Steve the pilot threatens to break down the door and put WD-40 on. You know, anyway,
well, I mean, look at Chicago. I mean, there's a case recently where the head of the internal affairs, her niece, happens to be piling around town in the chief's car with a known drug dealer who has a long rap sheet, who the police are following, who know what he does. And oh, yeah, by the way, her girlfriend is the niece of the chief of internal affairs, and they're driving around in her car. Let's see. I'm thinking there's something fishy going on there. So that's exactly what you're saying, is that there's this idea that we're now lowering the bar of the people who we hope will protect us from the ills of society that we've let fester on the vine for generations and generations and generations, and turned our eyes to it and fled to the suburbs to avoid it. And now it's coming home to roost, and now we're making it worse with these ridiculous policies. I think a correction, you know, a market correction in this mentality is generations down the pike, if anything.
Yeah, I don't know. We'll see. You know, the thought was that the midterm elections, that crime would play a big role. Things are getting incredibly complicated. Maybe it may be inflation. You know, who knows if the if the Roe leak and the Roe leak, you know, what we should be concerned about with the Roe leak is not the reversal of Roe. It's the leak itself, which is the counterpart of the inner city crime. This leak from the Supreme Court is probably the biggest blow we've seen yet to the rule of law and order and neutral constitutional government. It is absolutely terrifying. It signals the breakdown of every last institutional norm in this country. But who knows, you know, what the suburban white, even Republican feminist is going to think about, oh, gosh, you know, they've taken away my right to abortion, which is completely wrong. Anyway.
But so wait, about that, Heather, we're speaking, as I should have said minutes ago, we're speaking to Heather McDonald, fellow at the Manhattan Institute, writer of many books, including The War on Cops and others that you should read. I'm a big fan of hers, and she writes for City Journal. Now, the breakdown of the rule of law is what we're really talking about, whether it's Chicago, New York, Philadelphia, Los Angeles, anywhere. And what we're seeing playing out is that a leak happened in the Supreme Court, and that leak became a political bludgeon where you have groups outside justices' homes to threaten and intimidate them. And at the same time, we have the president of the United States silent. You know, the left says silence is violence, but John Cass says if they keep staying silent and this continues, we'll lose the republic because the other side pushes back too. And we don't want to, I don't want to see it.
Yep.
So, Heather, what is the significance in your mind? And can you please talk about a little bit more of that leak and the Biden administration's silence and Merrick Garland's silence on this thing?
I don't have the rhetoric adequate to do so, John. I don't. I this thing scares me to my marrow, and I would need to be a John Milton to be able to call up all the forces of hell and damnation to really express what this signifies for our future. It means that the Democratic Party has simply decided that it does not have to play by neutral rules. The only thing that holds our country together at this point, we are so divided culturally, our worldviews divide from the start of existence. You know, if we can't even agree that there are such things as biological males and females, and they remain so for the rest of their lives, there's virtually nothing we can agree on. The only thing holding this country together is a certain base level respect for neutral rules, for ground sort of constitutional principles that bind everybody without double standards. And the Supreme Court has to function in confidence and trust. Justices have to be able to draft opinions, to circulate them, to horse trade between the dissent, between concurrences, to have confidence that they can share their work product until they get to the point where they're ready to publish it. If now we have a norm where people who don't like the outcome leak an opinion, that makes the normal operation of the Supreme Court impossible. You cannot do it. If now you cannot circulate a draft controversial opinion without thinking it's going to be leaked to the press, everything is over. And the fact that the Democrats and the mainstream media have not condemned this, that they have gone on to say, well, the real importance, the only thing we should be talking about is the substantive opinion, is a terrifying thing, because it means that they now think that any institution that blocks their lust for power, that institution can be ignored or torn down. And when you tear down these neutral ground rules, which is what a constitution is and what constitutional norms are, that leaves you in a state of nature, and brute force is the only way to resolve disputes. And so no side has any confidence any longer that neutral principles or the neutral law will apply to the other side as well as to them. And so it becomes a state of nature of the all against all and the rule of the strongest. It is an absolutely terrifying moment. And the fact that the Democrats have been silent about it makes it all the more terrifying.
Agreed 100%. Oh, me too. Yeah.
Absolutely, Heather. It's the decay of the Republic we're watching in real time. And John and I have been talking about this for years. This is like the 330th episode of this podcast. And we started talking about how the FBI was being, you know, disintegrated before us, and our laws and our policing and all the institutions, because no one has any faith in Congress, because that's gone out the window years and years and years ago. But now you're right. Absolutely. We've taken they've made the Supreme Court a representative body in theory because they're going to browbeat them into falling in line, where they're going to dismantle anything that doesn't fit their worldview. It's just the death knell for our republic. It's just rather. You're absolutely right.
And intimidating justices. You cannot. This is a third world country. You do not intimidate justices. You have to respect the rule of law. You don't firebomb anti-abortion centers. You have to respect the rule of law. And, you know, I ask myself, do liberals accuse conservatives of double standards? I kind of don't think so. I think they accuse us of racism. But I think that the double standardism is really kind of a monopoly. I think the left has a monopoly on double standards. And so we play this game all the time, but it's so true. Imagine if this had been in the opposite situation. If, you know, a conservative had leaked a very liberal opinion, or if liberal judges were being surrounded and their families were being hounded, or an abortion clinic had been firebombed, it would be a constant 24-hour scream fest on CNN and MSNBC. But because it's liberals who are breaking the rules of law, breaking our norms, they don't give a damn.
I just want everyone who's listening to this to remember what Heather McDonald has just said, and I'm just going to add this. The long march of the left, the neo-Marxist left, through the institutions is evident in everywhere you look. It's evident in journalism today. It's evident in corporations where you have corporate leaders running, scrambling to donate to Black Lives Matter so that they themselves aren't subject to some sort of pain. And we see what Black Lives Matter did with the money. They had great parties. And all of this at the universities, in our politics, everywhere. And people who are alive today know the effects of it. I don't see that there's anyone, I don't see anyone on the national news from Civil War-torn countries talking about this or allowed to talk about it. Or how about this? My own personal experience, my father fought in the Civil War against the communists in Greece. The communists shot the teachers first, shot them in the guts, and let them to lie in the village square. And if a family ever came to help them, they too were shot. This is, my father told us this, it starts with politics. It starts in politics, political talk. And then the blood gets in your eyes and the politics is gone.
Well, and
yes, Heather. Sorry.
Americans are totally naive about unbridled government power. I mean, I think that right now every freshman is told to read Ibram Kendi's nonsense about America's endemic systemic racism. Here's what they should read: The Gulag Archipelago by Solzhenitsyn. We are completely clueless about the abuses of communist governments, the sadism that comes out when you do not have the rule of law, when you do not have a respected constitution. It's an absolute truism, but power does corrupt. It makes people drunk with their own power, and sadly, there is a joy in destroying other people and making them suffer and killing. We see that now, what we've unleashed in the inner city. And so, yes, we have to remember what we've seen governments be capable of, and be grateful for and do everything we can to preserve this extraordinary gift that we've inherited of a constitutional government and politicians that are allegedly bound to the rule of law. And if we start saying, oh, well, you know, we have to get rid of that in the name of good cause. We have to get rid of the First Amendment because, oh, we know what hate speech is, and we trust ourselves to define hate speech in a somehow rational way. Sorry, there is no exception for hate speech. If you think something is hateful or wrong, here's the solution. Battle it out, duke it out in the marketplace of ideas. But the left is now throwing over one constitutional safeguard after another. This is the same thing with belief survivors. You have these elite law students from Harvard and Yale law schools going around during the Brett Kavanaugh hearings chanting, believe survivors, i.e. any female who alleges that she has been sexually assaulted is due belief. She doesn't have to prove it. There's no assumption of innocence on the part of the accused. No, we assume guilt on the part of the accused. That too is an absolute assault on our jurisprudential inheritance and the rule of law. But it is all driven by self-interest and a belief that they will inevitably control power, and so they can seize the reins and not care for rules that share power and make sure that everybody stays within their guardrail. Well, you know, just maybe they will not always be in power. And do they really want to hand the power of censorship to their political enemies, or the power of biased investigations? I mean, I think January 6th was appalling. I think it was its own level of threat to constitutional order. It was not a manifestation of white supremacy. But you have now our Justice Department lying to us, saying that the threat to America comes from white supremacy. That's completely bogus. The violence we're facing in this country today has one source, and that is inner city family breakdown and the lack of socialization. These phantom white supremacists are not the problem, but our Justice Department is acting as if it did. We have these theater, the security theater of putting the fencing up around the Capitol because the white supremacists are going to come. It hasn't happened.
The all politics is local, as another Democrat said. And I just want to bring back, as we close, after all we've spoken about, what do you think of Heather McDonald? What do you think of Lori Lightfoot issuing the mayor of Chicago, a former federal prosecutor, an officer of the court, issuing her, quote, call to arms against the Supreme Court? What does that do? Where does that fit in all this?
So she has called for civil disobedience or for pressure to be brought to bear on the Supreme Court?
Yes. She put it out in a tweet. I talked about it in my column and with Megyn Kelly the other day.
It's horrible. It's absolutely horrible. You know, again, we are like children. We are completely ignorant about the fact that it took hundreds and hundreds, thousands of years of development to come up with the idea of limited constitutional government, separation of powers. The fate of most human beings for most of history was to live under tyranny, unbridled power, no separation of powers. The tyrant controls the judging, he controls legislating, he controls who gets picked up, who gets executed. The Supreme Court is one of the primary institutions that keep us safe, that keep us from facing civil anarchy. We have to respect that institution. And the fact of the matter is, I mean, this shouldn't matter, but that Alito opinion is incredibly closely reasoned. It is not an outlier opinion. People in the mainstream, liberals, as soon as Roe came out, said this opinion is a travesty. So the idea that Alito's opinion represents some kind of abdication of his judicial responsibility is ludicrous. The court is not a democratic institution. It is supposed to follow the law, and we should be careful about who we appoint to it. race and gender should not be a consideration in appointing justices. The only thing that should matter is, do they have the intellectual brain power to be able to keep our jurisprudence consistent, articulate, and persuasive? And we are also threatening the caliber of our Supreme Court by making race and gender paramount considerations.
Heather McDonald, I hope you come back, and I hope I can correspond with you, because it's just a pleasure to finally meet you, at least, you know, our voices. And I just look forward to the day that I can meet you in person. If you ever come to Chicago, please, and if I'm still here, please, let's stay in touch, all right?
I would love to.
And hope you come back.
Thank you, Heather, so much. It was enlightening.
Thank you so much, Mr. Carlin.
Just so good.
That was terrific. Great conversation.
Thank you. Thank you. The world of ideas is what I live for. And,
sure.
And I like listening to ideas of all kinds. A confession, I listen to commie radio, too. 820 on your dial. I listen
if you're in Chicago.
If you're in Chicago, I listen to and read whatever I can read to hear people argue things out. And I think that what in the most important week of our lives, this attack on the Supreme Court, right, and the attack and the what's going on in Chicago with the attack on civil order and the violence. I'm so glad that we had Heather McDonald here. I really am.
Yeah, a treat. Great to have a big thinker, as I like to say sometimes. And it was certainly just, you know, she's right. I mean, the whole idea that this we're going to look at the statistics one way or another and use one data point to say, well, it's all racist, we got to change that. I mean, her point about the idea that we have too many people incarcerated per capita based on other countries is very interesting. And it's this idea that if people take that number and say, well, look at that number. It's terrible. It's horrible. It's okay. But, you know, this country has turned its eye on mental health problems for generations, and it's caused lots of issues. And we have poor people who are afflicted by that much more than any other demographic. And we say, well, yeah, you know, we're going to do our create a law or a support
program.
System or
program.
A program, right, a program to fix that. But we don't. We just say that it's just to get votes. And you've seen it. I mean, Chicago is a case study in community leaders taking their community and seeing it as a voting piggy bank, where as long as they say the right things and they you know, grease a couple of hands here and there, or they have the right pastors in their pocket, you know, and then they keep getting reelected, and the promises and these programs keeps happening, but they don't do any good. And it's just brutal. It's just brutal.
Eventually, Jeff, the goose that lays the golden egg gets pissed off and doesn't want to get strangled and doesn't want to get open from crotch to eyeball for any more eggs. They just leave.
Right.
And what's happening is that the middle class in this town, the black middle class, the Latino middle class, the white middle class, are gone. And what you have left is Lori Lightfoot and her BS.
Yeah, and her big swinging D. Ugh.
And I'm glad I could not bring that up with Megan or Megyn Kelly. I did not touch it, or with Heather. I'm just so embarrassed for our city to have a mayor who speaks like that. But speaking of, you know, the big brain theory of Jeff Carlin.
Yeah,
check out the big brain on Jeff. Yeah, well, I've got big brain news.
What's that?
One of your favorite podcast guests, Nicholas Cass, a senior fellow with the State Department for many years, is now apparently writing an essay for the American Conservative on your favorite subject and mine and Charles Lipson's favorite subject. What is an American Kamalist? And what does that mean anyway, when we talk about the deep state,
right,
American Kamalism? And
look forward to that.
It's coming out, and we should have him on the podcast again.
Oh, absolutely.
So many people that we
want. Oh my gosh. Hey, John, and I'll take the moment too. There's a good big fan of the podcast. Michael Bossert is a former chairman of the Kankakee County Board. Big listener. He's a friend of a friend, John O'Malley, who we've had on before.
Oh, yeah, Johnny. Yeah.
Yeah, Johnny. So he's poor a friend John. Of his. Yeah.
Poor John working for that cycle.
I know. The poor guy. Right. I know. I feel for him every time I see her say anything about safety or security or ever see Brown open his mouth about anything, because that guy doesn't make any sense. He just talks out of both sides.
He follows. You know, I have a lot of coppers who hate Brown, friends of mine, you know, mm-hmm. and they want him fired. You know, look. Senior cops just take orders from, they follow orders too.
Right.
And you want them to retire, you want them to resign? Well, people don't want to walk away from that kind of money.
No, absolutely. Know? But Chairman Bossert had heart surgery recently. So we send I want to send a get well soon best wishes out to him. He's as far as I know, is a very good man and a big thinker, conservative, who enjoys our podcast. And I just want to give him a get well soon, because anybody dealing with any heart issues or health issues, it's tough. And being in the hospital is not easy. So get well soon.
Chairman Bossert, hope you feel better. And when you get out, Jeff and I will take you for a hot dog at Jim's Original Polish. Okay.
Absolutely.
Good luck.
Absolutely.
Good luck, sir. So for Jeff Carlin, my buddy, executive producer at WGN Radio, future physics teacher, and we've been all listening to the evolution of Jeff on these podcasts, where he went from one side of the aisle. Now he's not on the other completely. He's still independent, but he can see the faults in the arguments that he once thought were important.
And
I'm just saying that I see you.
I have not changed my opinion on the Constitution and its ability to give every human being and citizen the freedom to do and achieve what makes them happy. I've always felt that, John, and the parties may swing and twist in that piece of paper to fit their narrative or their protocol. But John, I've always held the fact that we all have the right to be who we want to be, as long as we don't impinge on someone else's right to be who they want to be. And that is full stop.
I accept the chastisement from Jeff because I deserve it. Yes, Jeff. But these arguments are quite compelling from Heather McDonald.
Absolutely.
And for Heather McDonald, senior fellow at the Manhattan Institute, writer of many books, including The War on Cops, and just a brilliant thinker, writer for City Journal and other publications. And to you out there who've listened to this, and, you know, maybe we could have stopped early, but neither Jeff or I wanted to, because we were just so compelled. It was so compelling to listen. Absolutely. Thanks for joining us on another edition of the Chicago Way podcast on WGN Plus.